This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the New Books Network podcast. I'm your host, Crawford Gribben. Today, my guest is Joshua D. Shindell. Joshua is Professor of Theology at Yellowstone Theological Institute, which is located in Bozeman in beautiful Montana. And we're talking to Joshua today about his great new book, The Necessity of Christ Satisfaction, a study of the Reformed scholastic theologians William Twiss and John Owen. And this book has just been published by Brill in their very, very good series, Studies in Reformed Theology. Joshua, it's great to have you on the show. Thanks for your time and congratulations on your book.
Thanks, Crawford. Thanks for the invitation. It's a real pleasure to be speaking with you today. I'm really looking forward to the conversation, or as we say here in my neck of the woods, to jaw-jacking about this topic.
So to jaw-jacking. This is going to be educational for me. Great. Yeah. Just feel free to drop in those little local allusions. I'll appreciate that and keep a note. Joshua, this is a very important book on a very, very big topic. This is your first academic monograph, if I'm correct. How did you make your way into theology? Make your way from a general appreciation of theology to this question, turn this question into a thesis for a PhD, and then eventually to turn that project into the book we're talking about today. What's the background to the project?
Well, as I'm sure you know, having worked on much bigger projects than even this one, but even these littler projects have probably several stories that could be told about their origin and development. I suppose in terms of my own interests in general in theology, I grew up as the son of a pastor here in a little town in Montana, Cascade, Montana. And so from fairly early age was interested in theology, things of the Bible, things of church. And that kind of, you know, carried on with me, throughout my teen years. In my late teen years, I got very interested in Reformed theology, or at least, what was being called Reformed theology or Calvinist, theology, at the time. And so I started thinking about what I wanted to do with my life in my late teens, early 20s, and over a period, just thought, you know, I'm really interested in pursuing this theology thing, philosophy, and so I was actually over visiting the Labrie there in the south of England. And I just happened to go at a time when one of the workers there was Stefan Lindholm, who at that time was working on his PhD through the University of Stavanger, I believe it was at the time, under Sebastian Renman, whom, as you know, had written his doctoral dissertation on John Owen, on John Owen's theological methodology. So I got to talking with Stefan Lindholm when I was over there, and he introduced me to the Reformed Orthodox and that kind of whole period of late 16th century through 17th century Reformed writings, which I was utterly unfamiliar with. And he encouraged me. He said, if you're really interested in studying theology and doing this more, go to Calvin College, as it was at the time, now Calvin University, and do philosophy, which I was very happy to do. So, as I say in the preface of the book, it was also while I was at La Brie, I was having tea out on the lawn, and I overheard Stefan Lindholm talking with another worker there who was there at the time. He's no longer there, Andrew Fellow. And they were discussing a different take on the necessity of Christ's satisfaction, although I don't remember if they used those terms at the time, but a difference of take between John Calvin and John Owen. And, you know, in my understanding at the time of Reformed theology was this kind of monolithic thing that went from its beginnings in John Calvin and John Owen to Jonathan Edwards to the Princeton theologians. You know, that was about all that I knew at the time. And so so that struck me as odd and maybe even a little troubling that there's this dispute on the atonement of Christ amongst Reformed theologians. It sort of blew some of my categories. So anyways, I tucked that in the back of my mind as something to look into later. So I went off to Calvin and studied philosophy and the classics there, and then did a master's thesis at Westminster Seminary in California on John Owen and his Socinian writings. And that's where I was first sort of introduced to John Owen's dissertation on divine justice, his Diatriba. And while I was reading that, paying particular attention to his writings on Socinianism, or from Socinus and from some of the Socinians, I discovered that it wasn't just Calvin with whom he disagreed, but some others like William Twiss and Samuel Rutherford. And so again, I sort of tucked that in the back of my mind. I originally began talking with my doctoral supervisor while I was still at Westminster. I began talking with him about possible projects. I should say who would become my doctoral advisor. He wasn't at the time. But I began talking about possible projects, and he thought we should go in the direction of writing something on Socinus and Socinianism, which in some of the literature on kind of the intellectual development of the early modern period, Socinianism got the short end of the stick, and he sort of had a sense that it was a bigger player in some of that development than the traditional story had it. And so I started looking into that, and I fairly quickly thought, after reading Socinus in particular, and some others, some of the English Socinians like John Corellius and John Biddle and some of those folks, I quickly thought, you know, I want to write a dissertation on someone or some persons whom I can really learn from the theological trade, really learn the theological trade. And it struck me, now this is an evaluative judgment, not supposed to make these, I suppose, as a historian, but it struck me that Socinus was not a very good thinker. He was not a very good theological thinker. He was humanistically trained, and somewhat of a decent Renaissance thinker, as it were, but not a very good theological thinker in my own estimation. And so I thought, I don't know that I want to write at length on Socinus. And so I pulled out from my back pocket these questions that I had sort of developed over reading Owen's Diatriba. And as I started looking at it, to make a short story long, as I started looking at the text and then started reading more of William Twiss and Samuel Rutherford, I thought, I originally had a chapter on Samuel Rutherford, but I thought he was pretty much saying the same thing as William Twiss. He'd written, about 15 years or something like that after William Twiss's first edition. And so I thought, well, I'll just focus on William Twiss and John Owen. So that's sort of the development. And I should add, by the way, I have a friend who's right now finishing up his PhD on Samuel Rutherford on the question of satisfaction. He assures me that Samuel Rutherford has his own kind of distinctives to add to the conversation. So I may have been mistaken on that point. But that's sort of how the project developed for me.
Great, Joshua. So you take us there to the idea of Christ's atonement as being central to what this project is all about. And often, I suppose, when people who have a knowledge of Reformed theology in this period think about questions relating to the atonement, it's about its extent, isn't it? And there's various positions taken in that period. But your book's about a much more fundamental question about its necessity.
Yeah, I think that's right. Even when you look at a lot of the literature on the atonement, especially when it comes to Reformed or Calvinist writings of the early modern period, there's a lot of secondary literature on the extent of the atonement, debates over the extent. What I discovered when I began looking into this question of the necessity of the satisfaction of Christ, and I suppose I ought to make a quick caveat comment here about, I'm sure I will slip in between using atonement and satisfaction in this interview. Strictly speaking, the Reformed didn't talk about atonement. That's just not a term that they use. So to avoid anachronism, I'll try to keep with satisfaction. But inevitably, I'll slip, I'm sure. So when I started looking into this question of the necessity of satisfaction, I found that actually the Reformed debated this question extensively, if you'll excuse the pun, as well. And so it became obvious to me that these two questions were debated, the extent of the atonement, for whom did Christ die, and the nature of the atonement, or whether it is a satisfaction in the first place, and that the Reformed were debating the Socinians in particular on that point, and then whether or not it's necessary. And they debated the Socinians, they debated the Remonstrants, they debated the fellow Reformed theologians on that particular question. So I was actually quite surprised to see the extensiveness of the Reformed debates on this topic. It's also, I think, worth exploring further. One could probably write a monograph, not probably, one could write a monograph on the development of the discussion in particular, from the conversations between John Calvin and Lilius Socinus, in the late, 16th century, all the way right through the 17th century. There's a development that occurs, I think, within the Reformed Orthodox response that has some doctrinal implications on the question of the necessity of the satisfaction. So that could be traced. I think it would be really enlightening if one were to do that. But that wasn't my project, so I didn't do that.
So Joshua, you're making a distinction there between satisfaction as the language of our early modern subjects and atonement as one of the terms that's related to that idea of satisfaction in more recent discussion. So just in case we're confusing any listeners, what exactly do we mean by satisfaction?
That's a great question, and one that's liable to get me into trouble. Because as you read both in the patristics in the medieval period and in the early modern period, there are different takes on what exactly satisfaction is. So what I try to do in the book, in order not to get too bogged down, is I say, for the most part, I think it's generally true to say that because of the way the Bible speaks about the work of Christ, one of the aspects of the work of Christ is the payment of a debt. This type of language is used in Scripture and then reflected on in the patristic period, medieval period, early modern period. And it's one of the ways in which all of the theologians in those periods talk about the work of Christ and what it accomplishes. So I say, without specifying what exactly the debt is or how exactly it gets paid, all that I mean by satisfaction in this book is that there is something like a debt, and Christ's work accomplishes something like a repayment of it. Atonement, in the modern period and into our own day, atonement sometimes is used to signify that. That is to say, satisfaction. It's a sort of a synonym of satisfaction. But atonement can also be used in our own time as encompassing sort of the whole of salvation. So it's more akin to reconciliation with God, or union with God, reunion, as it were. So that's how I try to differentiate those terms in the book. And I think, if I was successful, at least, I avoided the use of the term atonement almost entirely and stuck with satisfaction, again, by which I simply meant that there was a debt that sinners incurred on account of their sin, and which Christ, in some way or in a manner of speaking, repays, as it were.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Is that helpful?
That's helpful, Joshua. Yeah. And your book project is really exploring why there is a conversation between theologians in the 17th century, principally, but also a conversation that's set up by previous discussions stretching back several centuries, many centuries. But it's a conversation about whether the satisfaction was necessary or not. So could you talk us through why some perfectly orthodox Reformed thinkers might have suggested the satisfaction was not necessary? What would they have meant You parse this quite carefully in the book, but what would they have meant when they made that kind of claim?
Yeah. This was probably the place or the question by which I learned the most, actually, in my readings. Maybe I'll come to that by way of some of the discussions that take place going all the way back to Augustine. And you can actually trace elements of this question further back than Augustine. I've elsewhere traced them back to like Saint Irenaeus, for example. Certainly in Athanasius as well. But Augustine was so important, as we all know, for the development of Western Latin Christianity and theology, and was cited right through the Middle Ages. So the medieval scholastic tradition in particular. So Augustine, in his book De Trinitate, book 13, chapter 10, he offers up a sort of argument where he, in discussing the work of Christ on our behalf, he offers up an argument where God seems to be sort of on the horns of a dilemma. Either God could save fallen humanity sort of only in this way, by the incarnation. It had to be by the incarnation, by the suffering death of the God-man. Or he could have saved fallen humanity in some other way. Now, if you say that he could only save humanity in this way, by the suffering death, the incarnation, suffering death, resurrection of Christ, then you seem to be denying his omnipotence. We'll probably come back to that more in a moment, but you seem to be denying his omnipotence. If you say there were other ways of saving humanity, then by the gruesome, you know, suffering and death of his only son, then you seem to be denying his wisdom. I mean, surely this is not the path that wisdom would choose if there were other paths available. And so it would seem that either God is not all powerful or he is not all wise. And this kind of phrasing of the question is taken up in the medieval period. It is sort of formalized into an argument by Anselm in his Credeus Homo. And then it is taken up particularly by Peter Lombard in his Sentences, book 3, and he deals with it also in book 1. And so it then gets passed into the commentorial tradition. So I try to trace that in chapter 3 and show not so much a development, because I'm not actually arguing a developmental thesis. I try to be clear about that in the book. But I just try to show how certain distinctions sort of make their way into the discussion, distinctions which the medievals found helpful for trying to parse this. And that those distinctions then are taken up by the Reformed Orthodox in their own discussions. So that's kind of the issue that these Reformed Orthodox people are dealing with. Either God is unwise or he's not all-powerful. So for those who of the Reformed Orthodox who say actually the question whether God could have saved humanity by some other way than by the satisfaction of Christ, those who answer that, yes, God could have saved humanity by some other way, at least as I trace it in William Twiss, what's really at stake is our view of God. First of all, with regards to his omnipotence, can we really claim that he's all-powerful? And then Twiss develops several other arguments which say, if we say this is the only way that God could save fallen humanity, we're actually and probably accidentally, introducing into our doctrine of God, that he is able to sin. It's a really very non-intuitive, but I think pretty powerful argument, one that Owen had to contend with at great length. I could go on to that argument, but now I feel like I'm maybe outrunning the question that you originally asked. So,
well, Joshua, you very helpfully took us up to John Owen there, and Owen is, with twists, one of the subjects of your book, isn't he? And as you mentioned in the book, Owen changes his view somewhat in thinking about this question. So tell us a little bit about Owen as a, almost as an evolutionary figure in this conversation, as a person who's moving from one view to a slightly different view.
Yeah, there are probably a number of things that I could say on that point. What I found interesting is Owen was not the only one to have changed his mind on this issue. There were other fairly influential figures that round about this same time also changed their mind. I mentioned in the book Richard Baxter as being one of them, who, you know,
we don't mention his name very much in this show, Joshua.
Yeah, that's, I can imagine. So I was about to say, for all his disputes with Owen, he seems to have followed Owen on this, even in terms of the path he takes. So it's 2 years after Owen's first publication in The Death of Death, Richard Baxter comes out with essentially the same position as Owen, which was essentially the same position as Twiss, that it was not necessary. 2 years after Owen comes out with his diatriba, Baxter comes out with his own account in which he's changed his mind and follows Owen again. I don't know that he would have admitted to that, but that's sort of the publication record at least. So anyways, Owen, I think, was a really important figure in this. After Owen, I found that the majority of the Reformed Orthodox writers that I read, both in England and also on the continent, followed, if not Owen's argumentation, then sort of his reasoning that we better say this is the only way that God could save sinners because of the Socinians. So that's sort of the case that Owen makes. He essentially says in his, I think it's to the reader of his diatriba, that he had at one point, you know, taken up the position of Twiss and denied that there was any kind of necessity that God saved fallen humanity by the work of Christ. But he says, I've had some time to consider it, and especially with the rise of the problem of Socinianism in the early 1650s, he says, we don't want to establish a sort of halfway house between Reformed Orthodoxy and the Socinians, which is what he thought William Twiss and Samuel Rutherford and others were doing. So he changes his mind. He doesn't say too much more about the change of his mind, but he does say that much. And then after Owen, it seems like his argumentation and his reasons for wanting to affirm that this was the only way, are taken up in the Reformed Orthodox. So again, I think, you know, one could probably write on that kind of development. There definitely seems to be a shift. So Owen's really important for that reason. His diatriba is such an interesting work. I should say, if you look at my sort of table of contents and then look at the way that Owen's writings are organized, you'll see quite a bit of a difference. And one of the reasons for that is, as I note in the book, there are Owen approaches his subject with a different emphasis, I think, and a different style than someone like William Twiss. So maybe I'll make a quick comment about that. William Twiss is much more scholastic, both in his training, but also then in his writings. It comes out he organizes his material in a very scholastic fashion. Now, it's been noted, of course, that Owen does the same, particularly with his earlier writings. Probably when he was, you know, closer to his school days, he organizes them in a more scholastic fashion. By the time he gets to writing the Diatriba, I think Carl Truman has mentioned this too. His style is a little bit more in the Renaissance strain of things, Renaissance humanism, and so he organizes his material for the Diatriba very differently than does Twiss. So one of the things that I didn't want to do in this work was simply give a summary of William Twiss and John Owen. Part of the reason for that was because I thought if I give Twiss's kind of four principal arguments and go into detail about what he means by them, and then follow with a summary of Owen's Diatriba, it'd be very easy to miss the way in which Owen actually responds to Twiss. So I thought a real comparison of the two required a little bit more of an analytic approach on my part, where I was sort of taking Owen apart and trying to reconfigure his writings in a way that made explicit his response to Twiss, because I do think he actually gets around to responding to William Twiss. He does it in sort of roundabout ways. I'm remembering a comment by Paul Helm. He made it originally in one of his blog posts on Helm's Deep, I think is what his blog's called. But I think it worked its way into his book on Calvin's ideas, maybe. Anyways, I'm forgetting the exact reference, but Helm says, you know, one of the problems with Owen's Diatriba is that it dies the death of 1,000 qualifications, as it were. So, I tried to organize it just a little bit differently, so you could see you could compare the responses.
And I think that's one of the great things about the book, Joshua, is the way in which you show Owen responding both to an agenda set by Socinianism and by earlier formulations of Reformed theology in relation to people like Twiss, Rutherford, and others. It's a super book. It's incredibly learned. You deal with sources in multiple languages. You pull together a conversation that stretches back centuries in a very straightforward, very light way. It's very accessible, and yet it's dealing with such deep and significant issues, and as you explain in the book and in conversation as well, issues that require a huge amount of nuance and careful thought as to how to avoid the horns of that dilemma that Augustine sets up all those centuries earlier. Well, Joshua, congratulations on the book, The Necessity of Christ's Satisfaction, A Study of the Reformed Scholastic Theologians William Twiss and John Owen, published by Brill. What can we hope to read from you next?
Thank you. Thanks for the congratulations. You know, this position that I hold as at Yellowstone Theological Institute has kept me pretty busy with teaching. So I have it in mind to continue work on William Twiss. I think he's a figure that more study could be done on. And so I sort of have that in mind. I've been working towards a bigger project on William Twiss. In the meantime, I have written a couple of smaller pieces, an article that's under review right now on nature and grace issues in early modern Reformed theology that, if accepted, will come out later this spring. a piece on Reform Scholasticism for Matthew Barrett's a little online publication, Credo, which will come out, I think, here fairly soon. And then an entry for the reception of, the Encyclopedia of Biblical Reception on paradise in the Reformation period. So that was kind of a fun one to do. I'm not sure when that's going to come out, but that's what I've been working on of recent.
Well, that sounds fantastic. Who doesn't love writing about paradise? What a great topic. Especially when you live in Montana, you just have to look out the window and describe what you see.
That's about right.
It's been great having you on the show today, Joshua. It's a great book. I encourage anyone interested in Twisser Owen or indeed Reformed Scholastic Theology in this period to take a look at it. The Necessity of Christ Satisfaction, a study of the Reformed Scholastic Theologians William Twiss and John Owen, just published by Brill in their excellent series Studies in Reformed Theology. Joshua, thanks for your time today. Thanks to everyone else for tuning in and listening. I'll see you next time on the New Books Network podcast.